From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, President Obama formally asked Congress for war powers authorization to fight the Islamic State, ISIS, ISIL, whatever you want to call it. The U.S. is bombing already. This would grant explicit and limited authority. For just 3 years, boots on the ground, yes, but no, quote, enduring offensive ground operations. Critics say it's too little. Skeptics say it's too much. This hour on Point, what's needed, what's wise to deal with the Islamic State? Joining me first today from Cairo, Egypt, for an update on how the fight with ISIS is already going is Borzu Dargahi, Middle East and North Africa correspondent for the Financial Times. Borzu, welcome back to On Point.
It's my pleasure.
Can you give us a kind of status of this conflict right now? Is the Islamic State still expanding? Has it been fought by U.S. air power, Kurds on the ground, and more to a standstill? Is it in retreat? What's the status?
Well, I mean, if you take a sort of bird's eye view of the region, you look at in Iraq and Syria, where ISIS controls very significant territory in the north of Iraq and in the east of Syria, northeast of Syria. And it is essentially, if you look at it broadly, a stalemate. ISIS continues to control much of Iraq's Anbar province. It continues to control Mosul. It continues to control huge swaths of north and northeastern Syria. There's a little bit of back and forth here and there. The Kurds have taken back some territory with U.S. help. The Syrian Kurds have taken back some territory. The Iraqi forces and Shia militias have taken back some territory in mixed areas. But in the Sunni and heavily Sunni parts of Iraq and Syria, ISIS continues to maintain control. In addition, you can't but help but look around a little bit more and see that, for example, ISIS is making inroads into Lebanon, a little bit into Jordan. It has gotten support of al-Qaeda, the Arabian Peninsula, in Yemen, where the kind of older jihadi group are hemorrhaging supporters to ISIS. ISIS has a presence now in Libya, where several jihadi groups have sworn loyalty to it. And it has also gotten a presence in Egypt, where same thing has happened. Sinai-based jihadi groups have sworn loyalty to it. So it's not only is it hard to say that ISIS is being rolled back, it does seem that in some ways it's expanding, increasing its influence, and definitely increasing its presence throughout the region.
Borzu, when you call it a stalemate and go on to describe what that looks like, it sounds like a kind of, at least for now, ISIS on a victory path. I mean, after all, they've carved a would-be state out of two formal nation states in the face of all kinds of opposition. You describe expanding influence in the region and into North Africa and well beyond their immediate locale. That hardly sounds like being rolled back at all.
Well, I think that it is more, their successes are more a function of the failures of various governments around the region. For example, Iraq, a huge failure, huge swaths of the area. Syria, as listeners know, the victim of a horrific civil war, which has torn the country to shreds. Yemen, huge, vast, ungoverned territories. Libya, now in the midst of a civil war that has given these jihadi groups and ISIS-affiliated organizations an inroad. So it's largely not so much that ISIS is succeeding, is that the states are utterly failing to maintain control in certain territories, and ISIS is just moving in very rapidly and aggressively into those areas.
Is there a regional presumption or consensus here about ISIS that it's either a temporary phenomenon, you come back in 5 years, it will be gone, or that it's putting roots down for the long term? How do people in the region see it, Borzu?
I think it's a very good question. I think people are still somewhat in shock. They don't know what to make of it. It's this sort of new phenomenon, very media savvy, very sophisticated in its own way, appealing to not, you know, just angry, disgruntled people or potential insurgents like in Iraq during the U.S. occupation, but appealing to people from cosmopolitan backgrounds in Europe and even the U.S., drawing people from urban centers around the region to support it militarily or via social media and so on, boost it. And I think people are still trying to get a grip on what it all means and whether this is a force to stay, whether it's going to fade away, whether it will fizzle out, or whether much more kinetic action is needed.
And finally, Borzu, speaking of kinetic action, a lot of talk about that, military action in Washington yesterday. In the region where you are, when people hear the U.S. talking about, you know, it's already bombing, it's already supplying arms and working with the Kurds and others, when they talk about full-on authorization, war powers, something maybe bigger coming, are people in the region saying, you know, okay, here comes the U.S., ISIS is going down? Are they saying, uh-oh, here comes the U.S. again, it's going to be more chaos? What kind of reactions are you hearing to the talk of a full authorization of U.S. military intervention?
Well, because of the U.S. role in the region and its kind of stature, no matter what the U.S. does, it's going to be criticized. If it intervenes, everyone condemns it for intervening. If it doesn't intervene, everyone condemns it for letting a genocide unfold, as in the case of, for example, Syria. So I don't think there's any winning there. But I think that right now, at least, and having spent much of the last year going in and out of Iraq, and I'm heading there also on Monday, the strategy in Iraq, at least, I think is the strategy that the administration's strategy is the only game at this point. Help build up Iraqi forces, help build up ground forces, provide air support, not just to help logistically and tactically, but also to buoy the spirits of the Iraqi forces and the Iraqi nation. This was a country that was literally, when ISIS moved in on Mosul, on the verge of despair and utter chaos. And when the world came to help, this really stiffened their resolve to stand up to ISIS. And I think that is, for now, in Iraq, that's the strategy. Syria is another story. Syria is a much more complicated and a much more tough nut to crack, and in many ways, disastrously, Syria is really the incubator of ISIS. And if you don't resolve Syria, you don't resolve ISIS.
The Islamic State, ISIS, spanning both of those countries, and as you say, its influence now moving beyond. Borzu Dargahi with the Financial Times in Cairo. Thank you very much for being with us, Borzu.
It's been a pleasure.
A formal request for military authorization of military force yesterday by the White House, but the president also yesterday laying out his big strategy. Here he was.
A systemic and sustained campaign of airstrikes against ISIL in Iraq and Syria, support and training for local forces on the ground, including the moderate Syrian opposition, preventing ISIL attacks in the region and beyond, including by foreign terrorist fighters who try to threaten our countries, regional and international support for an inclusive Iraqi government that unites the Iraqi people and strengthens Iraqi forces against ISIL, humanitarian assistance for the innocent civilians of Iraq and Syria who are suffering so terribly.
Big multi-point plan. And this bottom line, no more prolonged ground war in the Middle East, said the president. Not necessary.
I'm convinced that the United States should not get dragged back into another prolonged ground war in the Middle East. That's not in our national security interest, and it's not necessary for us to defeat ISIL.
We're going to hear a range of views today on what is necessary in this case. Joining us first from Norman, Oklahoma, Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Spent a lot of time in this region. Joshua Landis, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for asking me on, Tom.
You see what the president is asking for here. It's formal green light from Congress. It's got some restrictions in it. It would expire after 3 years. No enduring offensive ground operations, he says, whatever that means exactly. Is this what's needed for success? And what is success, Joshua?
Well, that's the big question, is what is success? And in Iraq, we do seem to have a formula for that. There is a central government that we are willing to back, and we're pouring in arms, training, and we've sent 3,000 troops over there to help with that effort. In Syria, we don't have a strategy. Essentially, our strategy is to drive ISIS out of Iraq and contain the violence in Syria, continue to degrade ISIS in Syria. But we don't really have a solution for Syria because the government of Bashar al-Assad, also a Shiite sectarian government, we're not going to arm them up to reconquer Syria. And the opposition, most of the rebels are ISIS or Nusra, the al-Qaeda branch in Syria. They dominate rebel territory. There is a small other, there are many other militias that own a very small part of the real estate. We're not going to really arm them up because Americans don't want to spend the money. It's all about the money. It would take hundreds of billions of dollars to arm those rebels up in order to conquer all of Syria and solve this problem.
So what do you say to people
America's
that say in that case—
America's not going to do that?
Yeah.
Obama's not going to do that.
We're talking this hour about President Obama's formal new request for war powers to fight ISIS and what's really needed or not needed to deal with the Islamic State. Here was the president yesterday as the request went to Congress saying this is not authorizing another Afghanistan or another Iraq.
The resolution we've submitted today does not call for the deployment of U.S. ground combat forces to Iraq or Syria. It is not the authorization of another ground war like Afghanistan or Iraq.
No ground forces? Well, not exactly. They could go in, it says, to rescue Americans, to go after ISIS leadership. Here's the president again.
This resolution strikes the necessary balance by giving us the flexibility we need for unforeseen circumstances. For example, if we had actionable intelligence about a gathering of ISIL leaders and our partners didn't have the capacity to get them, I would be prepared to order our special forces to take action.
And they would go, boots on the ground. Skeptics in his own party were not so sure that there was an ambiguous bright line around the depth or the extent of this American authorization. Here is Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff of California.
The other major issue is the language pertaining to ground troops, which is very broad, very ambiguous. None of us really know what enduring offensive combat operations means. And deliberately, I think, drafted to be ambiguous.
Others who may favor heavier action didn't want to see restrictions put around the commander-in-chief's war powers here once the U.S. gets focused on that. Here was John Boehner, House Speaker.
If we're going to authorize the use of military force, the president should have all the tools necessary to win the fight that we're in.
And others want boots on the ground, heavy, and soon. Here was Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, on CBS's Face the Nation last week.
An aerial campaign will not destroy ISIL. You're going to need boots on the ground, not only in Iraq, but Syria. And there's got to be some regional force formed with an American component, somewhere around 10,000, I think, American soldiers, to align with the Arab armies in the region and go into Syria and take back territory from ISIL. That's what will make it stop.
There's a big span of impulses here. Joshua Landis is with us, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma in Norman, Oklahoma. With us now from Washington, Rulmark Garek, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, focusing on Iran and Iraq, Afghanistan, terrorism, intelligence. Rulmark Garek, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Pleasure, Tom.
And with us, Andrew Basevich, retired U.S. Army colonel, professor emeritus of international relations and history at Boston University, West Point grad back in 1969, not sanguine at all about U.S. military action here. Andrew Basevich, thank you for joining us.
Hello.
Rulmark Garek, what do you think of the president's request? Is he asking for enough? Is he right to try and, at least in the language as presented, self-limit?
Well, I mean, I think the president is obviously doing is trying to establish a legacy. I mean, this is not about authorizing current military operations. The president has not shown particular fidelity or concern about congressional oversight. I think this is primarily a means to get his type of foreign policy, which is a minimalist foreign policy with strong aversion to the use of American military power, to last after he leaves office. I don't think this is really about defeating ISIS. There's nothing in that that would make you believe that we are on the path to victory.
There's going to be a lot of debate about exactly what ought to be done and the wording of it in the next weeks, but let's talk about the substantial thing on the ground. What would be good for the U.S. strategically, security-wise, long-term? Are you with Lindsey Graham? Go in there, 10,000-plus American troops, real boots on the ground again, ally with locals, and get the job done.
Yeah, I mean, I would be in favor of many more ground troops in Iraq. That's going to be difficult to do now because the president, regrettably withdrew troops from Iraq. So now you're in a much worse position. We now have 3,000 troops. I don't think that's going to be enough. The Shiite militias and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps are not going to be able I think, to take back much Sunni territory. The Iraqi army, though not completely collapsed, needs a lot of help, and it's primarily Shiite. So I think the notion that you are going to be able to conquer the Sunni sections of Iraq with a Shiite force is mistaken. And unless you have more American troops on the ground, I don't think you're going to have any means to do that, though I'm willing to admit right away that given the disastrous decision to withdraw from Iraq, American credibility is incredibly low in that country. So I'm skeptical that this president has no intention to engage in the sort of rough diplomacy that would be necessary to get American forces back into the country.
Josh Landis, you know, the end game here, I'm not sure what it is, but the existence of the Islamic State is kind of a rebuke to international order, as the U.S. has tried to oversee it anyway. Is it, will it take more boots on the ground? Is Lindsey Graham right? Would that help, Josh? Or after our decade-plus experience in Iraq with 100,000-plus troops, have we learned that that doesn't do it? Or is it different now?
It wouldn't help. We don't have an answer for Syria. We can't put troops on a third of Syria and try to hold it. The Turks aren't willing to help us, and we don't have Arab partners. So we can degrade ISIS, but we cannot destroy ISIS. Only the regional powers can destroy ISIS. And as you heard Borzu say in the beginning, This is about failed states in the region. We can't nation build. We tried that in Iraq. We tried that in Afghanistan. We're not going to do a new job in Syria.
No Arab partners? What about Iraq? That's at the heart of the president's vision of the strategy here. Work with the Iraqi government, build it up, and along with it, roll over ISIS.
We can do that with Iraq. We have a central government we're willing to support. It is sectarian, but at least 60% of Iraqis are Shiite. In Syria, we don't have that option because we're not going to help Assad. We could do it, but it would destroy our standing in the world. We'd be supporting a dictator. They're a minority in Syria, and we've demonized Assad, and he's brutalized his people. So we're just not going to do it. Syria is not that important to the United States, and if we go in halfway and then get trapped there, it'll be very damaging for the president. Unless you're willing to spend hundreds of millions of dollars, you're not going to begin to fix Syria.
Andrew Bacevich, all the options on the table yesterday anyway in Washington were military options, and it was a matter of degree and what limitations there might be put around it. Were they real or not real? Should they be heavier or lighter? What about the military response to what we're seeing with the rise of the Islamic State? Is this the way to go, Andy?
No, it's not. But I do think that the president's request really offers an opportunity to ask what I think is the right question. And the right question really is not, what should we do about ISIS? The right question is, how are we doing in the larger enterprise of which the campaign against ISIS forms a part? As others have already alluded, we've been engaged in a military effort to do something in this part of the world, whether it's to democratize it or pacify it or stabilize it. We've been engaged in that enterprise for well over a decade. I think you could argue that we've been engaged in it since 1980. And guess what? It ain't working. So the notion that an expanded war against ISIS is somehow going to lead to, is going to reverse our string of failures, seems to me to be a bit of a stretch. If people believe that the application of U.S. military power in the Middle East more broadly is going to fix the problem, then certainly we're going to have to apply U.S. military power on a scope far beyond anything that we've done so far. And the political support at home for doing that simply does not exist.
Far beyond what we've done so far, we went in about as heavy as we know how to go in Iraq, didn't we, Andrew Bacevich?
Well, yes and no. You know, if you put the Iraq war and the Afghanistan war in a broader historical context, they really weren't very big wars. My war, the Vietnam War, we had over a 500,000 troops on the ground when we finally admitted that it failed. I think that the Iraq troop strength topped off at something less than 200,000. But you get to the point. If we want to fix Iraq, and of course, Iraq is only part of the problem, then we're going to have to go into Iraq with, what, 500,000 troops and leave them there how long? 2 decades? And if you stabilize Iraq, well, what does that do with regard to Syria, Afghanistan, Libya, Yemen, Somalia, and so on? So the issue here is, I believe, and this is what the debate over this presidential request ought to focus on, is, to put it bluntly, is war the answer? If it is, then by golly, we need to try a lot harder than we've been trying. If war is not the answer, then we need to radically rethink our strategy.
We heard Ted Cruz yesterday, Republican senator out of Texas. He doesn't want U.S. troops, Kurds. He wants to give them more support. But he said it's all about military action. Here's Cruz.
The solution to ISIS is not eradicating poverty throughout the Middle East. The solution to ISIS is not expanded Medicaid in Iraq. The solution to ISIS is to hunt down and kill the terrorist leaders.
Rule mark correct. Ted Cruz is not sure it should be U.S. troops in volume doing that. But is war the answer here? Andy Bacevich says the evidence is that that hasn't worked and we're not willing to go in 500,000 plus and do it. Is war the answer, Rule?
Yeah, I think it's part of the answer. I mean, I would also disagree with Andy. In 2008, I was in Baghdad and I was walking around. It was a little unnerving at times. But, you know, the progress in Iraq had been enormous and substantial until this president decided to throw it away.
Americans wanted out of there, you know.
I have no problem with the United States staying in Iraq for quite some time, as I have no problem with the United States staying in Afghanistan. The United States has stayed in a lot of countries since World War II, and I think for everyone's benefit. I don't think your Islamic history doesn't suggest that you are going to be able to deal with radical Islamic militants through peaceful means. Now, I suppose if the United States were to become Switzerland, then you might not have to worry about it. But the United States isn't going to become Switzerland. So it's going to be a problem. And I think if you have another substantial terrorist attack, then this gets rewritten quite quickly. Until that happens, I think the president's desire and his to see essentially a withdrawal of U.S. forces from the region is likely to hold the high ground. If you were to have another substantial terrorist attack, then I think that all gets washed away. And this entire discussion, for example, of a military authorization will become history. It's largely irrelevant.
Let's go to our listeners, Steve in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Steve, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the administration, President Obama and the administration, putting forth draft language for this resolution. That's great. That's exactly what the administration would like for Congress to give them.
Yes.
However, it doesn't limit Congress to say, okay, we'll either give you that or we won't give you that. Congress could say, okay, we'll give you that, but there's no deadline on it. There's no way we need to be telling ISIS or anybody else in the world that this is the only amount of time we're going to spend there. These are the only things we're going to do. Don't worry, we're not going to do this. Don't worry, we're not going to put troops on the ground.
Well, Steve, let me be clear. The 3 years is just an authorization. Of course, it could be re-upped. President Obama says he wants a new president after 2016 to have this that would take it into the new presidency, but then it'd be the new president's to work with Congress on. He's not saying no boots on the ground. He's saying he would put special operations forces in there to go after leadership, to rescue Americans. Do you think this is heavy enough? Do you think it's not heavy enough, Steve? What would you like to see?
It's not heavy enough. But again, we don't need to be telling the world and our enemies specifically what we're going to do. We're only going to put special ops on the ground to save American lives, to evacuate embassies. We're not going to come after you. You're welcome to go anywhere you want. Don't worry about it.
Steve, we've got it. But what about telling ourselves it's a democracy? You've seen the experience in Iraq and Afghanistan. Very costly. Went on for a very long time. Don't Americans have a right to have some sense of what their government is taking them into?
The Americans don't have a sense of what the government's doing on anything because the government is hiding everything they want to do. I'm not some conspiracy theorist, but I spent a quarter of a century in the United States Navy. I've been to Iraq. I know what's going on there. And I know that what the president's asking for is not enough.
Steve, I appreciate your call, and let me get one more, if I may. Austin, Texas, Paul is calling. Paul, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Look, I think this is a huge mistake, and it again shows that the United States doesn't understand what's best for the Middle East. We should not be getting involved yet again. If we really cared about stability in the region, we would have supported Assad and supported Syria as a single state. Whether or not he's a dictator doesn't matter. If we genuinely cared about stability, Iraq would still be intact. Syria would still be attacked.
So think about security. Not our fight at this point. Don't get into it. Andrew Bacevich, what is the answer? If it's not military, and you raise huge questions about that, deep questions about that. And Rule Marker Rex says, we're not Switzerland. We're not just going to hide up in the mountains. We're out in the world. What's the answer?
Well, I don't think that the alternatives are either overreach or becoming Switzerland. At the end of World War II, when the United States and its allies identified a threat called communism, led by the Soviet Union, the architects of U.S. policy put together a strategy of containment, which was not a perfect strategy and certainly was not perfectly implemented. But the idea of containment did provide the base, a sound basis for policy over the course of the Cold War, avoided World War III, and produced, at the end of the day, a satisfactory outcome. Now, this challenge is not identical to the challenge posed by the Soviet Union after World War II, but arguably, it is possible to formulate another strategy of containment, which would, in fact, posit that the solution to the problems in this core of the Middle East are going to have to be devised by the people who live there, rather than imposed by the United States or anybody else. And could I simply say, you know, that this notion, this notion being peddled, that somehow the Iraq war ended unsuccessfully because of Barack Obama is utterly, completely, and totally absurd. It was the invasion of Iraq by George W. Bush that shattered this region and has us today dealing with some of the consequences of that misguided decision.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Obama's formal new request for war powers to fight ISIS, the Islamic State, and what's really needed or not needed to deal with this situation in the Middle East, in Iraq, in Syria, and with influence well beyond. All kinds of views here. Ted Cruz again saying, let's get a lot of military force in there, but let's not have it be American soldiers. Let's really arm up the Peshmerga, the Kurds.
American boots on the ground should always be the last step, and we need to exercise other steps before that. We have the availability of overwhelming air power, and we have boots on the ground that are ready and eager to fight the Peshmerga, and they lack sufficient tools and equipment to
Senator,
do so.
We'll talk about what the Kurds could do with more American support. Josh Landis, Rumak Correct, Andrew Bacevich, lots of response here. From our listeners, I mean, you know, the basic split we ask, would you vote up or down on this? Sean says, no, Iraq is no longer our problem. All troops should be removed from the Middle East. Aaron, kind of visceral response to ISIS, says, yes, kill them. Lee says, as an Iraq war vet, I've already suffered and watched our tribe suffer because of the violent warmongering of our fathers. Retire, old men, and let your children find peaceful relations with our Mideast brothers. I don't know if ISIS looks at themselves as our brothers, but, you know, there's the range. Jack says, please stop using the term boots on the ground. It reduces the reality that we're sending battle-weary men and women, sons and daughters and parents, and that is quite right. These are not boots, though they do hit the ground. These are American citizens. Rumar Correct, what about Ted Cruz and others who say, no, not Americans in force on the ground. Let the Peshmerga, the Kurds, be the tip of the spear on this. Arm them up heavy.
I don't think it's terribly credible. There just aren't enough Kurds. The Kurds have no desire really to operate outside of their own terrain. Now, I think we should arm up the Kurds. I think the Obama administration has done a rather poor job of that. And if we had been more helpful to the Kurds earlier on, I think some of the tragedy that occurred in northern Iraq wouldn't have happened. But the Kurds are not going to be a solution to this, the notion that the Peshmerga are going to operate out of the Kurdish region just isn't credible.
Joshua Landis, what about Andrew Bacevich's parallel or notion here of containment, Cold War style? We did it with the Soviet Union. and communist insurgencies, Soviet-backed insurgencies around the world, do it with ISIS.
Well, I do think it's the only possible solution for us. We don't have partners. As we just heard, the Kurds cannot do this. They don't want to occupy big swaths of Arab land. And we don't want to encourage them to do that because there are places like Kirkuk. There are other very dangerous regions which are half Arab, half Kurdish, and they've been struggling for these areas for a long time. If we encourage the Kurds to take all that, we're setting up dangerous. The Turks are not our partners in this. We've just heard that the Turks were arming al-Qaeda groups because they're trying to bring down Assad. We don't want them to do that. A defector from ISIS recently explained that big columns of ISIS troops were let through Turkey by Turkish police in order to circle back and attack the Kurds, our partners.
Wow.
So here, you know, Turkey wants to use ISIS to hurt the Kurds. We're trying to use the Kurds to hurt ISIS. This lack of a common goal in the region is going to completely sink any efforts of the United States to send troops in there. If there's not a clear goal by the region on who should be ruling Syria, and you'd have to get a better government. In order to destroy ISIS, you need a better government. I just spoke to a friend who lives in Syria on the border. His family's from the border on the Euphrates in Syria, Bu Kamal. He lives in Saudi Arabia, but he went and spent 3 weeks with his family. He said when he came out, he said, my family and the whole town of Bu Kamal, they like ISIS better than the six Free Syrian Army militias that were ruling it before because it was terribly unsafe. The six militias were fighting each other all the time in the town, and at least ISIS has brought order. And we know we don't like them, but we know how not to get hurt. We follow their rules. And that was the prevailing attitude. So unless you bring a better government than ISIS, you shouldn't just – you can't send in American troops to provide that better government.
Joshua,
you have to have a regional Syrian government that will be better than ISIS. And we don't have an answer to that
problem.
Well,
let me ask you then.
So we should stay out. We should degrade and limit their power so they don't kill Americans and they don't expand. But we really don't have a solution.
Let me ask you then, to go to our listener's impulse, Sean, who says, you know, get all of our troops out of there. Like, let the region sort itself out. If ISIS is such a problem, could what if we did that? What if we washed our hands of this?
Well, I don't think we should wash our hands. What we need to do is degrade them and contain them, as Andrew said. We can't wash our hands completely, but we can't move tens of thousands of troops in there because how the hell would we get them out? You need to be able to have a better government, and we don't have a solution for that because we're unwilling to back the rebels and we're unwilling to back Assad. And if we don't have a solution, and the idea that we can build up a Syrian army that's pro-American in order to push out the rebels, troops that own half part of Syria and the government is pie-in-the-sky talk. We're not going to do it. So we should understand that we cannot fix this and that if we try to do it halfway, we're going to make a much bigger mess. And that's just the problem. We couldn't defeat the Soviet Union. We had to contain them. Patton was fired. He wanted to go to Moscow and fix Russia. And we just couldn't do it. And I don't think we can do it in Syria either.
Andrew Bacevich, containment relied on partners. Josh Landis says, we don't have partners here. We do not have effective partners. You hear what he's describing in the Turks and the Syrians and the Iraqis, even the Kurds and their limitations. So what would a containment-style policy mean, Andy?
Well, I think chiefly it would mean erecting effective defenses against the threat to us emanating from that part of the world. And the threat to us, or to the West more broadly, is relatively limited. I mean, ISIS is a heinous organization, a murderous organization. They don't have an air force. They don't have a navy. To the extent that they have any armored vehicles, as far as I can tell, it's tanks that they captured, that we gave to the Iraqis, that they captured from the Iraqis. So we should not treat ISIS, or quite frankly, the larger scourge of Islamic radicalism, as posing an existential threat to the United States. It actually poses less of a threat to the United States and to the West than did the Soviet Union.
Well, but let
so
me ask
erecting
you.
Erecting effective defenses is the most important step to a strategy of containment.
The president did assert yesterday in his comments as he sent this authorization request to Congress that if ISIS isn't stopped, it would become a threat to the U.S. homeland. Andrew Bacevich.
Well, I think that overstates it. And quite frankly, I think it was last week when Susan Rice was introducing the new national security strategy. I think it was a talk at Brookings.
Mm-hmm.
She made the point that the threat we face from Islamic radicalism is not an existential one. So it simply makes no sense as a basis for strategy to begin by implying that your adversary has capabilities that it doesn't. And by the way, I am not arguing that at this particular moment in time that we should cease all operations against ISIS. I think a continuation of the current campaign emphasizing air power may have a positive effect in terms of degrading and perhaps defeating ISIS. But my larger point is, even if we defeat ISIS, the achievement will have been a limited one, that the sources of instability in that region will continue to persist. And that's why it seems to me the question to be asked is not what to do about ISIS. The question to be asked is, why is it that all of our efforts up to this point to bring stability to the region have failed?
Rumar, correct. Here is Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia. This was on the CNN State of the Union. To Josh's point that we don't have good partners, he said the U.S. shouldn't do the work that air forces and armies need to do. Here's Senator Kaine.
We cannot police a region that won't police itself. And so the ground troops need to be from the region. But the United States' strong support via the air campaign, via training and equipping, helping guide the air campaign to make that effective. That's what we should do. That's what we are doing, and we can do more of it.
Rumar, correct. Keep on keeping on here. Andy Bacevich says something of the same thing, and the senator there saying we can't police a region that won't police itself. So let them take care of the groundwork.
Well, I don't think that's terribly credible. I don't think you're going to be able to lead from behind here. Containment always against the Soviet Union, for example, always involved an enormous commitment by the United States, including at times war and certainly proxy war. Now, I'm all for using others intelligently and effectively if it's reasonable and you can expect them to do the work. I just don't think in the Middle East with the Saudis or the Jordanians and the Emiratis, I mean, that's just not credible. I actually think we've been testing Andy's thesis, and we're going to certainly through the rest of Obama's term test his thesis. And I don't expect to see any substantial American commitment either to Iraq or to Syria increase unless we see terrorism against the United States, terrorism of a substantial scale.
You know,
If you do have that, if you do have the loss of, say, of 2,000 or 3,000 American lives, then I think, again, this takes on a different dimension because you obviously – no American president can allow thousands of Americans to be killed and then essentially get engage in a policing operation, which is what Andy is talking about. So we'll have to see. And if Afghanistan collapses and Ayman al-Zawahiri goes back to Jalalabad, where bin Laden landed in 96 and proclaims victory, it's going to be an interesting moment. Up until that time, we are going to continue the type of counter-terrorist practices that have been used since the Bush administration, and we'll see whether the dike holds. It may, in which case Andy will be proved correct. If it doesn't, then I think you're going to see America get much more militarily aggressive.
Gabe in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Gabe, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Sure. Hey, Tom. I think that we definitely need to get involved in taking on ISIS more directly. However, I also, this whole time it's been clear what ISIS wants more than anything else is for us to get involved, right? There's nothing that legitimizes ISIS more than having, the evil power of America attacking them. So, I don't know. We may crush them, we may destroy them, but we may just create 10 more ISISs in the process. And, you know, like Professor Bezvich says, unless we undermine their brand so people don't want it anymore, so we're not the problem that they're up against, unless we do that, you know, we're never going to stop this problem.
Gabe, I appreciate your call. Real Mark correct? You know, there was no ISIS before the U.S. got in here. That the very existence of it, some trace back to American major intervention in Iraq.
Well, I mean, you have two things coming together here. One, you have the collapse of Saddam Hussein's fascist order inside of Iraq brought on by the American Anglo-American invasion, which I think, you know, it's pretty hard to find 80% of the population in Iraq who would view that as a bad thing. In a larger sense, you have the collapse of the legitimacy of the despotic regimes that rule throughout the Middle East. I mean, that's what happened with Assad's regime in Syria, where the Sunnis finally just rose up and said, we're not going to take it anymore. Now, I would agree with Andy that in part, just in part, the collapse of Saddam Hussein's regime did send shockwaves through the region. It introduced a much more vigorous democratic debate. It introduced a much more vigorous debate about what is a legitimate political order in the region. And that had repercussions throughout the area, which developed into what is colloquially known as the Arab Spring. I would prefer to call it the Great Arab Revolt. That process is going to continue. I don't see that ending. I think you may have moments of pause, as we now have in Egypt with Assisi, until it starts to really boil again. Syria is going to stay the way it is until the Assad regime falls. And that's really a question of numbers, is how long the Alawites can maintain their armed forces. Certainly the Russians and the Iranians have been pouring weaponry behind the Assad regime, which has allowed it to stabilize. This may hold. It may not. It really, you have to look at the casualty figures of the Alawites. And if they continue to go up, then eventually I think that regime is going to crack.
Andrew Bacevich, we've just got a minute here. Real Mark Arek suggests if you don't get in there strong, you get meltdown and terror that ultimately hits American shores. Andy, what do you say?
Well, again, I think it's important to take a bit of a historical perspective here and to evaluate what our engagement in this region, our military engagement over the past 3-plus decades, has produced. And there is zero evidence that we have the capacity to turn back the disorder and the dysfunction that prevails in so many countries. We have tried to, we've taken a stab at nation building with Iraq and Afghanistan as the two primary examples, and neither one of those produced success. So the notion that continued military action is going to produce a different result seems to me be kind of a faith-based approach to strategy rather than one rooted in fact.
There will be weeks of debate on this in Congress. We will follow it. We will not let it go. Andrew Bacevich, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Real Mark Gorecht at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
And Joshua Landis at the University of Oklahoma Middle East Studies Center. Josh, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.